Oh, hey again, Can't Lit listeners. I have an announcement. Before we get to the regularly recorded in quote-unquote studio part of the podcast, I need to let you know that I have a few clips to play for you from the writer Eva Crocker, who wrote the amazing short story collection, Barreling Forward. Unfortunately, she was unable to come to Vancouver for the ceremony celebrating the Dane Ogilvie Prize, sponsored by the Writers Trust, which she was a finalist for. So what I've got here is something that she recorded and sent from the East Coast all the way to us. And I'm just going to play it now. She just has a few excellent things to say about her book and about writing. And then you will be into the usual Can't Lit experience of just me inappropriately swearing and everyone saying really smart stuff and me just being in awe. So here we go.
I'm really excited to be a finalist for the award, and especially alongside two writers whose work I admire so much. For question number two, I hope that there's a shamelessness in the book. When I was writing it, I was reading Lynn Crosby's Liar, which is a book I totally love. And I think what makes that book so powerful is the honesty and the shamelessness and the vulnerability that she puts on the page. And I would love to think that reading that book had an influence on Barreling Forward. And as for the emotional core of the collection, what I was really trying to explore was that Newfoundland had just gone through the boom and bust of the oil economy. So employment is very precarious. There was this huge financial crisis coming down the pike, and people knew that that would lead to services being cut, people losing their jobs, and I just sort of wanted to capture that atmosphere. So that's sort of the emotional core of the book for me. For question number three about the future of short fiction, it's funny, I was actually talking to Marilyn Simmons, who's an author and a friend of mine here in Wingham, about this very question, and she had this really interesting observation. She said that the heyday of the short story was around the heyday of the magazine, because magazines would publish short stories and people enjoy reading them in that format. And maybe it's not that people don't like short fiction, but they're for some reason intimidated by buying a whole collection of it bundled up in one package by one author. For some reason. So I don't know, maybe we need a new format for short fiction. But also I think people who love it will read it, and who cares about everybody else? They can read the things that they love and be happy to read them. I'm actually full of rage right now for Newfoundland and Labrador's provincial government and Nalcor, the Crown Corporation, who are building the Muskrat Falls hydroelectric dam, because Beatrice Hunter, who is an Inuk grandmother and a land protector, has been arrested and put in Her Majesty's Penitentiary, which is a men's prison in Newfoundland, which is overcrowded. It's been called inhabitable. There's currently a lawsuit trying to get the prison shut down because it is so dangerous there. And Beatrice has been arrested for peacefully protesting the Muskrat Falls development because it's threatening people's health and their way of life. It's already caused flooding, which wiped out an entire community, Mud Lake, and that flooding could have easily taken lives.
Hello, friends. And hopefully frenemies who are hate listening to this just for fun. Very exciting episode here for you today. We are celebrating the Writers Trust of Canada, Dane
Ogilvy Prize. See, it's already getting rowdy in here. As has been our want recently, as Daniel is not around, no disrespect. Really miss that fucking guy. we have guest host Jensu Fong Lee.
Hi. I just sent a text to Daniel. I miss you.
I'm glad that you probably use like a bunch of O's and U's. It's great. Honoree yesterday, Allie Blythe. Hi, Allie.
Hi. Hi.
Yeah, that's better. I'm training Allie on the mic. Doing great. Also, winner of the Dane Ogilvy Prize, Kai Chang Tom.
Hi, Kai.
Yay. So happy that you're here. And the MC of yesterday's ceremony, former guest, Vancouver Canlit favorite.
Oh, come on.
Favorite.
Poetry Dreamboat.
Stop.
Actually, everyone in this room is a Poetry Dreamboat. Leah Horlick. Hi, Leah.
Hello.
Hi. So I guess that's it. Great work, everyone.
Good podcast, guys.
Coordinating this already was so much effort. No, we're doing great. Let's just start in on what's happening. Who wants to go first? Who wants to tell us what's happening?
I can do it.
Okay, Jen, I want Jen to go.
Okay, I can do it.
Okay, so this week was a roller coaster, but I had this big meeting. Can't really talk about what the meeting was about, but a very big meeting, and I was a little bit late, and I had to set up a PowerPoint presentation, which I'm not really good at because I'm not like a business person. And as I was doing it, I was like freaking out and running around. And then finally, when I was ready to like do my thing, I stood up and I realized that the lining of my dress was tangled in my underpants.
Oh no!
And I was trying to like brush it off from the outside because it's not like I could really stick my hand under my skirt and like pull it out. But I was a little bit late, couldn't go to the bathroom, and I just did it anyway with the lining of my dress caught in my underpants. Mm. And then I went, after this whole 2-hour meeting was over, I went into the bathroom and cried and pulled. Oh. I know, but it was good. It was good. It's not a sad story. No. It's kind of funny. I was trying to dance my way to get the, like, I was doing this like weird shake to try to get the lining of my dress out of my underpants. This whole time I was like, hey everybody, this is what I think I should do with this thing and this meeting. And like, hi, you love me, right? You love me. Even though I look weirdly bunchy around the hips, it's all cool. It's all good. Mm. Yeah, it was all good. That was what was happening. Also, I have been emotionally vomiting for like many days now, but it's cool. Mm-hmm. What's happening with somebody else? You guys all look stunned. I love it. The stunned look is great.
I mean, I can go.
Yeah, go, Kai.
I'm always stunned whenever anyone asks me like, how's it going? What's new? What's up? You know, because the way I see it, 8 years ago, I turned 18 and then was like, I'm running away from home forever to go to university. And then suddenly, you know, I was like a punk, and then suddenly, like, you know, like a queer punk, like doing protests. And then suddenly I was gay. And then, suddenly I was a woman. And then I'm still in a perpetual state of like, I'm a girl. That's what's new. And
I honestly really hope someone pulls those out. I mean, I can do that and just like, they can be used as like great little clips to like drop into anything anyone
That's
needs.
The thing. It's like, don't send your kids away to university because suddenly they will be gay.
No, everybody do like, exactly what's happened.
Don't run away because suddenly you'll be trans.
If you want your child to be amazing, follow the Kai path. Yeah. That's what I'm going to say. Like, this is a good path.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's like, you know, so I think it's worked out, but I'm not sure because I'm still in shop.
Yeah.
But I mean, speaking about, I'm a trans. If you're not trans, you can't say a trans. Only trans people can say that. For the listeners.
Trans or trans.
Or like one tran, right? Yeah. Like tran being the unit.
Like the basic unit.
And then you get multiple trans, right?
You get to pluralize.
You accumulate transes. Oh, okay, no. And to those of you who are not transgender, you can't make these jokes. Only. No.
I can make those jokes.
You can make them. But for those who are listening who are cis, you can't make the jokes. Let's see. So I'm one tran right now. I'm a transgender person. And, you know, I was like, you know, I was thinking like, you know, it's going to be terrible with my parents because they're so conservative and it's going to be awful. And we had some hard moments. It's true. But generally things have been wonderful. But one thing that's been like, I've noticed coming back here was that, I've become recently, and all Chinese women do this eventually. Like I had a reckoning, you know, like a clothing reckoning with the Chang Sam. I don't know if people know what that is, but that's like the collar dress, you know, like that's like the famous Chinese dress. So, you know, every diaspora Chinese woman is like, should I wear this? Should I not? Mm-hmm. What's it like when I see it?
Will I look like a dim sum waitress?
Will I look like a dim sum waitress or like an airline hostess?
Oh, Cathay Pacific, airline attendant, you know, hog house, you might. What do you want? Yeah,
exactly. Right, which is not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
But like, you know, it's like, you know, what I go for and like how will particularly white men see me, right? What if this happens, what I think about.
Oh, fuck
you know?
How will white men see me in a choke song? Fuck it, because you know what's going to happen.
Right? So okay. So I then saw, like many Chinese women, saw Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love.
Beautiful movie.
In which Maggie Cheung wears, I think, like 75 different Chang Sam. And I was like, I have to wear them now. I have to wear them all the time. So you know, found a bunch in vintage stores. And then I wore one to the Dane Ogilvy Prize yesterday because I was like, I'm going to make a statement, a subtle clothing statement about being Chinese. My mother will be so proud of me. but then I was like, maybe she'll be ashamed of me because, you know, I'm standing up there wearing a dress. And my mom has generally just been very loving. But she was like, you know, about your Chang Sam, it doesn't fit you.
What?
It's too small for you. She was like, she went all like loving and like critical.
Oh, that's okay. That's
loving,
okay.
Loving, critical, the way moms do. And so I've been thinking about this, like, wow, it feels great to have my mom fussing over my clothes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a girl. But then also I'm like, mom, could you not be so critical? Oh. And so that's what happens when you're trans. You're like, maybe my mom will love me. And she does. But then you're like, oh, but then she becomes critical of my fashion choices.
Well, I wish I was there. I would have been like more loving and less critical.
Anyway,
I have actually never worn a chunk ever in my life.
My recommendation is that you don't like, is that you could wear, you can get the ones that are like vintage that don't have the like shiny silk patterns and then they just look more like everyday clothing, but they have a different shape. And then, you know,
it's a great disappointment in my mother's life that I've never worn a chunk song, not for my ill-fated wedding, not for like anything. And anyway, we can talk about that later, but yeah, the chunk songs, never worn one. So how did it feel? They're beautiful dresses.
Yeah.
And they make everybody look good.
They make everyone look great because they just hug you.
Yeah.
Hug you.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say that you looked really great yesterday.
Oh, that's
you looked beautiful. Gorgeous. Everyone looked amazing yesterday. That's one of the great things about, I think that maybe is surprising to people about literary, like ceremonies or galas, is that people actually really do look nice. Like you think they're just going to be like, whatever, I got some wrinkled pants and like a weird cardigan. I'm just going to throw that on. But no, people pull it out and it looks good.
Yes. Very much so.
I was just gonna say, because like we did one, and I like my dress was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, and it was great. Weighed like 70,000 pounds, but it was cool.
Yeah, you looked great. Allie was also at that. That was at the BC Book Prizes, and you looked very stylish.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
My suit, not my hirsute.
Before we started recording, we were using the word hirsute extensively, like maybe too much.
There's no such thing.
So I'll go next, and then I'll let you guys go. My Nona passed away recently, and she was a seamstress.
Oh, no way.
So I always, when I get dressed and when I think about my clothes, like I think about her because there were so many times when she would be like, this doesn't fit. And she would literally just grab you, bring you down into the basement and be like, I got to do this. I got to make these adjustments. I have to fix this. Like she was a very amazing perfectionist. She was an amazing cook. Like she did everything domestic that I'm terrible at because I'm not good at any of it.
It's okay.
Because domesticity sucks, in my opinion.
It sucks.
Other people can like it, but I'm not into it and I don't care about it. But so Loredana Dalbuccia, very cool. Someone told me that that's a super rare name.
Oh, really?
Which I didn't know.
It's Loredana.
So like, yeah.
L-A-U-R-E.
L-O-R-E-D-A-N-A.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
It's a great name. It's a great name. Her maiden name was Unti, which is also a great last name. Yeah. Anyway. You know, she had like pretty bad dementia, which is so fucked up.
Yeah.
But it makes you think about that part of your brain and like, or just a random role. You're like, what's going to happen? Am I going to, that could happen to me. That could happen to anyone in the room. And just knowing, especially as someone who, I mean, really toot my own horn, but like uses my brain a lot. Yeah. You know, it just, yeah, it just makes you think about like all the things that you potentially will lose mm-hmm. in your little brain.
I wonder if you've been writing long enough that you will be able to continue writing, not that you're going to get dementia, but if you were to get dementia, if you'll be able to continue writing through that and what that would look like. Mm-hmm. Are there people out there writing with dementia?
I don't know. I think there probably are. And yeah. I think we'll find out more because, like not necessarily studies in dementia, but the way that dementia is more commonly diagnosed now. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more dementia. So I'm sure we will end up seeing things like that, mm-hmm. that people will potentially write. I mean, I hope so. I hope I'm writing the wildest poems of my life with my dementia.
Or maybe they'll get super classical. Like I could start doing sonnets and like,
oh yeah, I'll only be doing like
about yeah. death form, and yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, that is possible. And my Nona was for a long time, she was very precise and she was really fun and loving and great, but she was very serious about things. Like she did not like us to color out of the lines. She would be like, come on, what's going on here? Like, why aren't you pulling this shit together? And would kind of like heckle us while we played checkers if we made mistakes, which when I was younger was scary. But then as I got older, became funny because I realized that it was, again, coming from this place of like, oh, I want to do this. But also that's a funny character trait to like get on people about their checkers playing, like a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old. It's funny.
She's like Yoda, right? You either, what is it? There is no try, just do.
I don't know. We've already gone over this. I hate Star Wars. I think it's terrible.
I do too.
It's a terrible cultural phenomenon that I'm never going to get.
Fuck
it's
you,
fine.
Star Wars.
George Lucas, get out of my face.
I have a really good story about the Star Wars thing, which is that like I dated this guy for a while who's super into Star Wars, and he kept saying things to me like, how does Chewbacca thermoregulate? And I'm like, I don't give a shit. Maybe he sweats. Maybe he pants. Maybe he shits his body heat out of his asshole. I don't care.
Again, if other people enjoy it, I fully respect their choice to get on board, but I'm not on board. No. Anyway, my Nona was great. She was amazing. She definitely did make me a pencil skirt one time because something had happened to my other clothes and she was just like, whipped it out, whoa, pushed it through her sewing machine. And then she was like, you're going to wear this now. And I was like, great. I love it. It's amazing. It looks great. I can't believe you just did that. I'm not going to be able to do that. Yeah. But our one true, I think, shared thing is we both really loved ice cream.
Yeah.
I mean, still love ice cream. So I've been eating so much ice cream this weekend, and I regret nothing. My current recommendation is Haagen-Dazs has an alcohol line.
Is there actual alcohol?
I don't think there is. It's just like inspired by it. So this is vodka key lime pie, and it has bits of pie crust in it. And the pie crust part is amazing. I thought it was going to be weird.
Like, why isn't it just key lime pie flavored? Like,
I mean, there must be some. There must, because also vodka doesn't taste super strong. So I feel like if you had the bourbon one, maybe it would taste more. The bourbon chocolate one. Anyway, whatever. Haagen-Dazs is doing us all sorts of favors. It's summer now. So I'm all about summer. And frozen treats.
Product placement.
Yeah, product. Please, Haagen-Dazs.
If you're listening,
get on board.
Send us $1 million.
We recently joined the Antica Podcast Network. Oh. So fancy. I know they only have some sponsors right now, but maybe they can get Haagen-Dazs on board. Because I'm all about this. Leah, Allie, who wants to go?
Oh, please. Go on ahead.
Okay. Well, speaking of alcohol, which is all anyone ever speaks about when one is sober, mm-hmm. I find. But like I live yeah. in the West End at the moment, and I'm on the path from Davie Street down to the beach from the liquor store. So it's just like tons of people just going by with 6-packs and 12-packs and 18-packs.
Are you like at the lower part closer to the beach?
Yeah. Okay. So then – and. Oh. Yeah.
That liquor store is also really messed up.
That liquor store is so messed up.
Is it messed up?
It's messed up.
When I was a child, we used to bribe people to buy us stuff from that liquor store.
Yeah.
I feel like it's that type of liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the other thing about living here is like I'm on Instagram and I go onto Instagram and I see, you know, Dina down at the beach and some fabulous romper, or I see like my DJ cousin down there all in an orange bikini doing some like futuristic alien photo shoot. And I'm like, and then I'll run down to the beach thinking they'll be there. And but it's like it's Instagram Sunset Beach is like some weird world slipstream to real. To real. Because I go down there and it's just like me and a bunch of other dog walkers.
Allie, we'll make a date. Okay. I would love for you to join me at the beach. I'm usually just by myself reading.
You don't look like you're by yourself, but just from the contortions of your body against the sunsets and the...
Yeah. Right? I mean...
It looks like a lot is happening.
Do you have a selfie stick? How are you
I don't have
photos?
A selfie stick.
Do you ask tourists?
I definitely have asked people to take my photo at the beach. I'm very committed to, especially as I age, my bikini photos. Yeah. Like, as my body gets older, it needs to be documented even more. But yes, please, let's go to the beach. Also, I want to hang out with your dog.
Oh, what's your
dog? My dog, Jonah, is a husky Akita.
Oh, God. So does Jonah have eyebrows?
Jonah has beautiful eyebrows.
Oh. Don't even with that. I can't with dogs. My dog has eyebrows also.
Oh.
Your dog is gorgeous. Yeah.
My dog is...
What is yours?
She's a big hairy mutt, but she's kind of like a collie, shepherdy mix.
Maybe this is why you like hairy men. Oh, that was too much. Cut.
No. No, it's okay. No, you don't have to cut that. I do like...
Sorry, I forgot
It's fine. Pretty much nobody I've ever dated is going to listen to this thing because they avoid me like the plague. So it's fine.
Inexplicably.
Inexplicably, because apparently I'm a witch. It's fine. We can talk about me being a witch later.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Get into all of it.
Yeah, it's cool. I love dogs. Dogs with eyebrows. How old is your dog?
My dog is 7, and he also doesn't have a tail because he was actually hit by a train when he was 1.
His tail?
And he lost his tail. So I do have random people getting really angry at me for docking his tail.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Docking.
Docking means like when you cut it off when
you're
born.
Why would you do that?
Some people do that. Like Australian shepherds get their tails docked. Like Rottweilers get their tails docked.
But like why?
Dobermans, it's like a weird thing that they think it looks better.
It's like circumcision.
Hold on though. How do you handle those people? Yeah. Like do you just make them feel really bad about themselves?
Well, when
by
I was first on
story?
Testosterone, I reacted by just yelling at them really loud and following them and continuing to yell at them and then realizing I can't do that as a man anymore. Mm. I have to like change my behavior. Mm. And so now I just get sad. And tell them the whole story about like...
Oh, I bet they feel so bad.
Him being hit by this train and then the nice RCMP officer picking him up off the train and carrying him to the hospital and then the town fundraising to pay for the surgeries. So by the end of it, they're crying and they feel so badly.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, wait.
They
okay, wait.
Feel badly.
Yeah.
Your dog's gorgeous.
Our Thank dogs you. Have to meet.
Okay, let's
because
do that.
Clearly this is a thing. That's my dog.
Okay, dog photos are happening.
That's my dog.
Look at you too.
Oh, well, I'm fine.
Was there just a photo of my cleavage?
Yeah, there was. I don't know who did that. Amber? Amber Dawn.
Oh, is that
okay, Leah, please. What's happening?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. What's happening? That's a huge question.
That's my dog.
Oh.
Just kidding.
You can go real micro if you need to. I guess so. I have been really anxious all week because I had to go to the gyno. Is it okay if I talk about having to go to the gyno? Is that going to be okay?
We've talked about it on other episodes, so please do.
It's low detailed and rich, so I like... did my thing and I self-advocated and I was all proud of myself. And then they were like, okay, you've done so well. We're going to get you your blood test and you're going to be all done. And I was like, sweet. I love needles. This is great. This is not a problem for me at all. And the nurse was having a really bad day. I hope you're not listening to this nice nurse from the options clinic. And she was like, this is going to be so easy. Your veins are so huge and you're not pregnant. And I work in the downtown east side all the time. About the downtown east side. And I was like, just get it over with. Seriously.
You're probably clenching super hard.
Well, I was just like, clench your fist.
I'm like, that's not a problem if you won't stop talking.
She's like, shit. Shit, goddamn. And I was like,
a nurse?
I know. Into my arm. And I was like, can I help you with anything right now? And she was like, no, I'm just having a really bad day. And I was like, well, considering that you are stabinating me in the arm right now, could we maybe talk about...
Did you say stabinating?
I was like...
I love you.
Yeah, I was just like, I'm really high on adrenaline and you're trying to take my blood right now. It would help if you would stop cussing like a truck driver into my face while I'm here in this night doctor's office. She was like, I can get it. I fucking swear I can get it. And I was like, we're going to stop this blood test right now. And I would like you to give me a requisition and I will go get this done later. You've probably worked a really long day. And she was like, well, I have. I'm so sorry. I was like, time to go. So I too have been eating a lot of ice cream. Normally these things don't bother me at all.
You are a great self-advocator though. Most people would just take the stabinating.
Well, you know, I do this for other women all day. Yeah. And I thought, Leah Horlick, you can do this for yourself right now. Mm-hmm. Normally it doesn't bother me at all. But I was like, you are a danger to yourself and others. You should go home. Your job is very hard being a nurse. So yeah, I've just been taking it easy.
No, that's good. I mean, you deserve to after that experience.
Stabinating.
The stabinating sounds terrible.
It's not good. No.
Blood work can be so easy or so terrible.
It's true. Fortunately, it doesn't bother me at all. So I was like, I'm fine.
It didn't used to bother me until the one time I passed out and then threw up in a recycling bin at the clinic. I had to go to the hospital. And then they gave me like 17 EKGs. It was a great day.
And you were fine?
Eventually they let me go. Yeah, they're like, you're good enough. But I was...
Is that a service they can provide? We can just go to the hospital to have someone tell us we're good enough? That would be great.
That would be so affirming. It felt okay, and then I left. But yeah, it was really bad. I'd never had that happen before, and I'm usually really great with giving blood, but I'd had to fast, I think, for too long.
No.
I like to eat every 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was not happening. But I was next to this young woman who was there because... she had also passed out, but because she had drank a bunch of vodka and done cocaine night. And she was there with some, like, she was probably 22, and this guy was, I'd say, in his late 40s, and he was clearly cheating on his wife from the suburbs in town, got a hotel room at the Four Seasons. No. So I'm sitting next to this young woman the whole time, and I'm like... like a blanched omelet. I'm so white.
A blanched omelet?
I'm so pale and like I have no blood in my body. I've thrown up so much. And she's asking me advice and I'm like, fucking don't have sex with that person anymore.
Don't do it.
Like, don't quit fucking that married guy. And I wanted to die. I was like, I feel terrible. I have no energy. I haven't moved and whatever. And I'm like, yeah, that's not good. And she was waiting to find out if her nose was broken because she had fallen face first, passed out from all this. I know, it was horrible on the marble floor of the Four Seasons bathroom.
You got a Four Seasons hotel room?
I know. Like, he was really trying, this fucking monster.
What a jerk.
Anyway, what a dick. He's terrible. anyone could have dated him.
Oh my God.
It was bad. That's my worst blood story. But, like, I'm glad that you took that into your own hands.
Well, you know, yeah. I had so much to look forward to this week, and yesterday was lovely. It was really so nice, with the exception of the fact that by the time the event was over, all of the food had been taken away, and I could not bring you your celebratory glass of wine, Kai, otherwise.
Oh, yeah, you know what they should do with those things, though? They should have, like, at the end, special sparkling wine and non-alcoholic sparkling things.
Yeah, some sparkling
available
juice in there.
So that everyone can toast, because I loved hosting.
Yeah. Actually, that would have been really nice.
That would have been so great.
Yeah.
Just have a little toast. Like, even little kids love toasting. You teach them to toast, and they're like, yeah, we get to celebrate. They, like, throw their juice in the air. They're like, they love it.
I did find it so...
Trust of Canada.
It was so celebratory. They did a beautiful job with the location.
It was really great.
Yeah, and the lifting up, the luminescence of the occasion. I thought they did well.
It was luminescent.
Jane Eaton Hamilton's speech. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Cries all around. It was beautiful. Yeah, it was so good. I'm sure they did this in Toronto last year. I have event brain, so parts of it are, like, flashy, and then parts of it aren't there. But, I mean, Jane was just really kind of transcendent yesterday. Mm-hmm. It was good.
Yeah, she was. Jane is always lifts me up at any time. She's great.
Yeah, she's great. And I feel like the Writers' Trust really focuses on that stuff. Like, I mean, this was 5 years ago, but when I was on the Bronwyn Wallace shortlist, it was the same thing. It was like this beautiful ceremony, and I was under 35 at the time, and everything was great. but also, same thing. Like, everyone made lovely speeches, and they, with both Ali and Kai, and Eva as well, they had talked about... oh, we didn't mention Eva Crocker's book also was on the shortlist.
Eva, we missed you.
Eva, we missed you.
Karelian Books read in your honor, and
that's
it was great.
Yeah. And Eva did pre-record something that I have that I can add to the podcast.
Oh, what's happening?
Yeah. And also, when we're talking, you know, throughout the day, if you've read Eva's book, please feel free to comment on it, say anything, so that it feels like at least her work is...
People were reacting so well to it in the room.
That story,
like, wow.
The nice book is so great. I got it, took it to the beach, surprise. Yeah. Read it, just devoured that book. Yeah.
Great cover, too.
Yeah,
we're just looking at it right now. Yeah,
all these books have amazing covers.
I gotta say, They really do.
My dear friend, Kai Yunqing. We have very similar Chinese names, so people always confuse us. Did the cover for my book.
No.
I feel really, 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 really lucky that Arsenal Pulp allowed that to happen, because it just makes it all that much more special.
Oh, look, poet Anne-Marie Terza, author of The Quiet, is just calling me. I love Anne-Marie Terza.
That's the best.
That was awesome.
She came down and visited me in the desert with Garth Martins and Melanie Siebert, and we had a beautiful poetry workshop down there for a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
The desert?
I remember you were posting a lot on Instagram at that time, because I'm imagining everything you looked at was just insanely beautiful all the time, and you were just like, I can't not constantly document and make people jealous of this experience that I'm having. But I definitely was jealous, and it looked so beautiful. So
yeah, it was beautiful. Just like, I got to spend 5 months down there just writing my next book. Who gets to say that, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. And had family come down, and then these guys. So we'd wake up in the morning, drink pots of coffee, and actually work, like do poetry.
What's that like?
I know. Yeah. It was really nice.
Where in the desert?
Taos. Do you know Taos?
No.
It's this little Arizona? Artsy ski town in New Mexico.
Nice.
Yeah, really beautiful, for sure.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Is that where Georgia O'Keeffe did stuff?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, there you go.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good catch.
Vaginas as flowers.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super into that.
So just going back to the Dane Ogilvy, you both made really... I don't know if this is customary. Like, other things that I've been to, people don't necessarily speak so eloquently before they give a reading or at a ceremony like that. And I loved that you both made that choice, because your work obviously speaks for itself and is well worth honoring. But you both made these really beautiful statements before your readings yesterday. So I wondered if you could just sort of talk about that and just how meaningful it was to be a part of the Dane Ogilvy family.
Please.
I don't know. I get really nervous about attending queer events and about being nominated for queer things. Mm-hmm. And I have a struggle with it. I don't know why exactly. Mm. Being sort of separated out as a queer author. I'm sure maybe some of us at this table have had that experience. Like, there's a, you don't know what that's like. Yeah.
Well, I mean, being singled out as an author who is of color is certainly a thing that I've had issues with my whole career. Yeah.
Right. And so it just feels a little different. And so in the days leading up to it, I do have big struggles with thinking about myself and who I am in the writing community, and worried about how I'm going to be seen, if I'm going to be pigeonholed, which I feel like I haven't been. I've been very lucky. But I struggle, and I have little arguments in my head, and then I get into the room and I look around, and I just see all these people that I love and adore and have been so kind to me and my family. Right. And I'm really just learning how to embody being trans and queer, like myself, like I always have been, but to actually say, like, I am one of you. No, like, anyway, so to look around the room and feel all this outpouring of love. I so want to honor us, you know, I guess.
I think there's a real, like, in the development when you're, somebody who is an author, which means you're going to have to be public whether you like it or not.
Yes.
There's a resistance in the very beginning, or I think there can be a resistance to the way people are classifying you.
Yes.
And then at some point you just, okay, that's just the way other people are classifying me, and you just move forward. There's nothing else you can do, really, right?
Right. It's true. And like, I actually Googled queer poets of color. I Googled all kinds of things just to widen my family before I walked in that room, even, you know, and see people like Eileen Miles and Erin Murray and all these people. Like, they're just, I don't know, they're all there in the room doing all their different, Walt Whitman. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, Walt. Yeah.
Right? Like,
I feel that. I really do. And I mean, I think maybe from a different standpoint, I approach the same experience, or the same phenomenon from a different angle. I have been writing for forever in my life, right? Mm. But also have been out for a really long time. I've been out as a trans person in some way or another since I was about 14. Mm. And so came to came of age as a queer person and then a trans person before I came of age as a writer. And so have never lived as a writer outside of like a queer lit milieu or like a trans lit context. And so I couldn't even imagine what that would be like to not be classified in that way. And then of course I'm always Chinese too. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, you know, through the luck and also misfortune of growing up the way I did, you know, didn't even imagine like not being pigeonholed in this way. Right. Yeah. Because like my parents are, you know, like the classic Chinese immigrant. Right. My family has been in Canada since the 1920s. And so we're really wrapped up in that whole, like, you know, Golden Mountain narrative or whatever. So I never even imagined like what it would be like to not be pigeonholed. I didn't imagine like a life outside the pigeonhole until really recently. And you know, so walked into the Dane, kind of feeling that weight as well, right? Like who am I to be here and why me and not others? I spoke to this a bit yesterday too. And like knowing that, like last year, for example, there were two trans women of color who are dear friends of mine who were finalists also, who also did not win, right? And just to name that, and like to know that there is a project greater than myself at work that is political, mm-hmm. and always to grapple with that,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Like to be like, oh, my winning is something other than me, than just mm-hmm. my individual win. There is something else to be said about the community in which this is happening, and to be like, oh, great, I love being the vessel for that, and oh, I hate being the vessel for that too.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. I've been struggling for the last couple of days just with vulnerability mm-hmm. around gender specifically.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think I can go to this event, right? Aww. I don't think I can do it. And I was feeling very close to the surface, let's just say. And I was like, what am I going to do? And in the last moment, I was like, I'm going to iron my shirt and go do my job.
Yes.
I'm going to go do, yeah. right?
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. And the people were, I know it must be so much pressure, but the outpouring of seeing Gwen Benoway being like, yes, finally, mm-hmm. you know, and that like, oh, I was going to cry a little bit. And that like, little girls are going to be watching you, you know, all kinds of little girls, yeah. right? Like,
yeah. There are varying levels of comfort with being that visible and representing so many things.
Yeah.
And I will say that that's been the only thing that's kept me going is I have a job to do.
Yeah.
And I have
a mantra, hey.
But it's hard though, right? Mm-hmm. Like you go into an event and there have been events where I was dreading with so much here because I understand that I'm there for the Chinese reason, the woman reason, mm-hmm. the single mom reason. I understand that that's why I'm there. And then you go in and you don't want to do it. And I remember having a conversation with my dear friend, David Cherryandy. What's up? He's got a book coming up. and
do you want to have him call in?
Just yeah. David, can you call me? It's called Brother Fall 2017.
It's a nice title.
Yeah. He's cool. Yeah. And we had dinner together and he I was talking about how I didn't want to do this event and he slammed his fist on the table. He said, do not let them push us to the margins.
Yeah.
You're going to go, you're going to do your thing. And you're going to sell some damn books. And I was like, yeah. But then the representation thing is such a difficult thing. And I'm seeing both of your faces. Oh my God, you guys are so emotional right now. I love it. And
I don't know what you're talking
about. Yeah, it's fine. I'm always emotional. Everything's just right at the surface. Prick me a little bit, it all comes out. But there are varying levels of comfort. There are some events where you're going to be okay and you're fine. It doesn't matter. You won't even think about it. And then other events where you're feeling really crippled by that. Right?
Yes. And one of the reasons I thought Jane's speech in particular was so beautiful and that it set it up so well was that she just focused on the writing so much.
Yeah.
And it was just, she held up the writing because that's where we live. Ooh, that's where we are. You know, we're all kinds of things, but we are writers, you know, that's what we're doing. You know? So I thought beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Not a job too. That's all it is.
I look up to you guys because of your work. Like when I read both of these books, I read them both twice because I had read Allie's quite a while ago
because
when it came out. No, because I devoured it when it came out. And then I wanted to read it again before the podcast and just refamiliarize myself with your work. And the same thing with Kai's book. I had read it when the ARC came to me and then I was like, I need to read it again. And I think sometimes there are these situations where the idea of being pigeonholed holds some level of safety, but then the idea of also being a part of like
the greater world of CanLit is also extremely valuable because it so often is dominated by people that have, I'm going to use this phrase, been fucking shitty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to see people who are not a part of that gross team succeeding and having their work recognized is, it's fucking exciting to me, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And the work that you produced is phenomenal, and it's being, you know, rewarded because of that, mm-hmm. because it's fucking great. Let me get to my questions.
You're in Teen Vogue. I love Teen Vogue. I love that you're in Teen Vogue.
Oh yeah, Teen Vogue. Yeah.
Sorry, just because there was
no. We should talk about
there.
That. No, that's good. We can. We should talk about that though. Yeah. If you want to talk about it.
Well, okay, I have to first of all thank Brittany De La Cortez, who is a writer and journalist from the States, a fucking amazing single mom, queer, poly, I think poly, anyway. I'm saying this because all of the stuff is in her public bios. Brittany, thank you for bringing me into Teen Vogue. Who's breaking new ground in Teen Vogue. I fucking love Teen Vogue because Teen Vogue is like the best piece of freaky and journalism.
They're the best right now. They really are.
Ever.
Teen Vogue is the voice of the revolution.
And I don't know how many people know this, but it is also becoming really public that there was like a very recent editorial change at Teen Vogue. Mm-hmm. And now there is like a 30-something-year-old amazing black woman who is editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue.
Mm-hmm. Yay!
And like I think single-handedly in some ways bringing about amazing change at that magazine, and as a result of that in like the field of like young adult focused journalism in general. Mm-hmm. So that's amazing. And then also I guess I was in Teen Vogue for both of these books, which is great for both of my books, that is. Also terrifying. I don't know if I want to come how much I want to come back to this because we just went through like an emotional moment. I hate emotional moments.
No, we love emotional moments.
If you want to have more emotional moments, I'm fine with it.
I'm here for that.
I mean, like, it's the same emotional moment, right, in some ways, where I'm just kind of like, I just have all of this, like, you know, I don't know if it's, I think maybe a word for it is like survivor's guilt, except it's like a weird literary form or like artistic form where I'm like, why not these other people, right? Yeah. And then there is true survivor's guilt in the sense of like, why am I living and not other trans women whom I know who have passed away and whom I don't know also. And I'm kind of like, what does it mean to be in Teen Vogue? Like I really struggle with this every day. And like every day that my books are in the public and get more acclaim, which has been a lot in the past few months. I'm like, wow, do I deserve this? And maybe it's not about deserving, but maybe it's about doing your job for other folks.
Doing your job and understanding that, you have to have, we often all have coping skills for unhappiness and for sadness, and understanding that we need to have coping skills for success too, which is a thing that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
And I just had this conversation with Zoe Whittle actually, cause she has all the success in the world right now. And understanding that coping skills for success is not like a shameful thing and not an embarrassing thing, because that can really mess with your head, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Right. Totally. Yeah. I mean, funnily enough, I'm super glad that I am a therapist. I don't say that often, but because I spent a lot of time studying trauma, right? And one thing that's really ringing true for me right now is there's this amazing psychologist, Janina Fisher, who talks all the time about how as survivors of trauma, we live in shame and we live in guilt, and like experiencing failure really triggers that. But even more so, like happiness and success trigger shame.
Yeah.
And trigger,
so much shame.
Right? Because you're like, why am I exposing myself? What am I doing out here in the world as a public, semi-public person? Mm-hmm. And like, what does that mean for me? So I think about that all the time.
That's funny. When I was in my recovery program a little while ago, it was spring, and I get anxiety in my hands now. It used to be in my chest and my stomach when I was not on testosterone. And now that I'm in testosterone, it goes right to my hands. And I would get these really massive tingles when the counselor would say words like exist and deserve.
Oof.
Yeah.
Rather than things like trauma or sadness, I would be okay, but I'd hear these words and get these flashes and just like blank out a bit, right? Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, what do we deserve and why are we existing? Questions like this.
Yeah.
Just little old questions.
Just little old questions. Yeah.
Publish a book or two.
Right.
You publish a couple books and then everybody I don't know. I mean, I feel like the coping for success thing was a real issue with me all this past publishing season, just because the conjoined did fairly well.
Yeah, it did.
It did. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden people are asking me, specifically people ask me social justice questions all the time. Yeah. And it's my own fault because I talk too much. Mm. But, and I just felt so much like, I don't know if I'm capable of answering these questions. I don't know if I want to. Yeah. Maybe I should not answer them and point people to other directions. Maybe I should just talk about like my hair all the time on Twitter and it'll be fine. And like, but it's a very like distinct, when you're in a position where people are asking you things and want to engage in conversations with you, it's a really, how do you, because you're not always going to want to do that.
No.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And you're always not going to know, you're not always going to know how, right? Mm. Like, I think this, I love that comment you made about, like, the social justice questions, because they come, you know, I was just talking to a dear friend of mine who's also, like, a quote-unquote, like, famous trans woman of color writer in Canada. We're talking about, like what does it mean to, like, constantly be asked to do political representation when you didn't necessarily ask for that role, you know, and certainly wouldn't necessarily call yourself qualified to take on the role of, like, political expert or, like, sociological expert, but are constantly being asked questions because you are one of the few faces in the public.
Yeah.
I wonder about that all the time, like, why that happens and if it's appropriate to take that role and what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I think that for many years I really, like, struggled with that responsibility and it was really difficult and I would back away. But lately I've just said, screw it. It is just me ultimately at this point that, like, I understand that there's a kind of a critical mass of people who will listen to me at this point. And so I take the responsibility and I try to do it in the best way possible, but I'm going to make mistakes. I mean, people have called me out for stuff and whatever. You just have to, like, be able to acknowledge your mistakes and move forward, but also taking the responsibility and using it, trying just not to be an asshole about it that's all you can ask for. And if you do need to step away, you can step away.
Yes. Like, it's okay to deke away and actually just write.
Mm-hmm. It's okay to stop.
Yeah.
And just freaking tweet pictures of my dog.
Or tweet pictures of your beautiful dog.
My beautiful dog or my beautiful kid or like a good lipstick. Who cares? Honestly.
Yeah. So too. Thank you.
So we've been talking about love and there's so much love here in both of these books. And I actually Googled you guys. I'm so great. And, cause I was looking for interviews and you guys talk about love poems all the time. So I'm going to read two quotes from both of you.
Uh-oh.
Whose is whose?
Okay. We can't guess.
Yay. No, you guys have to be silent. Okay. Right or wrong. We go about trying to become one, don't we? And damage is done almost every time. I guess the answer for this book is probably no, you can't. That's a sad thing to say, but I don't think so. In the poem, the lovers know what happened last time. They've been taking all this time to put each other back together, and they're going to do it all over again. One. That's number one. Number two is, I think my poems about desire are in many ways my own attempts at creating a love poem out of moments in which I wanted to be but didn't feel loved. I think that these moments are very familiar to most people, but particularly to those of us whose bodies are demonized or reviled by mainstream society. Whose is whose, guys? I know whose is whose. Leah, guess.
Don't make me guess.
I'm going to make you guess.
No. First one's Allie, second one's Kai.
Yes. Hey. Yes. Okay, so my question is, how do you feel about love poems, torture or amazingness?
Good question.
Yes.
Both?
Well, yeah. We're poets. We always say both for everything, don't we?
I hope so.
And the title of your book is Two-ism.
Thank
so
you.
There you go.
That's a great point.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to do the other poet answer and say neither.
Oh.
All my poems are love poems, right?
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
They feel like love poems to me, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You to oneself, to other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are. It's interesting because, like, when I read both of those quotes from both of you, I like it's so appropriate for both of these books to me. Like, I read them and I'm like, yeah, of course, that's what Allie and Kai would say.
I love that quote, Allie. Is that from an interview somewhere? I have to find it.
Yeah, it's an interview. I think yours is from Quill and Choir.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And yours is, I don't know where from. I can't remember.
From either from Bitch or.
Is it Lambda?
Vogue, not Lambda. No.
I feel like it's Bitch.
Yeah, I think it's Bitch.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good.
So what I was going to say is I feel like both of you deal poetically super well with allusions to things. And I love that in both of your books, but they're both very, very different. But at the same time, I think we sometimes think of illusions as these sort of like elevated literary things, but they so often also come from extremely personal places. So, you know, if you're talking about religion or art, it's in some ways no differently meaningful than talking about your own past or your own history or the history of people in your lives. So I'm wondering how sort of the idea of illusions in your work are working and why they sort of speak to you. Because that's one element of both of your books that I really loved.
Mm. Well, for me, illusions are another way of just trying on another skin too, right? So in a way, they're a way of escaping in a way, right? No different than trying anything else on, I suppose. But it's also creating a larger community in time and space, I would say. For me, just they're just a part of the world I want to live in, right?
Yeah, I totally agree, and I love that about the way you,
the way you use them in Tuism specifically.
Oh, and there thanks. Are so many.
Yeah, it's like, even more in my next book, actually.
Oh, like, I'm exciting to
Ovid
me.
Crazy at the moment. I can't.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
so amazing. Yeah, so instead of like AA principles, I'm like the principles of Ovid's transformation, becoming.
Nice.
Right? Even though, like, oh, so rapey, so rapey.
Yeah. Ovid.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's interesting stuff. How about you, Kai?
Do I use illusions? Yeah, I do. It's funny because there was a whole sequence of poems that started out in the book that are no longer there. They're no longer in a place called No Homeland that were basically like Adam and Eve fanfic. like stories about the garden and stuff. And every time I showed those poems, the manuscript to an editor, the editor would be like, oh, this is great, but I don't know about these Adam and Eve poems. They don't like totally work. I don't know what they're about. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like maybe I'll like save them for another time. But yeah, similarly, I think for me, illusion is about connection. Mm-hmm. Like particularly lineage in ways that aren't always expected, like for sure.
Yes, yes.
Right? Like,
beautiful.
Like referencing mm-hmm. like trans women's work or queer work or mm-hmm. Like the work of just like other marginalized writers. But then there's like also community I want to build that like, yeah, it's like unexpected or like perpendicular in some ways.
And it's a way of elevating.
Totally.
Right?
Exactly.
Of esteeming.
You yourself. Yeah. You bring yourself, like it's about respect in some
exactly.
ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking particularly about like, there's a glossa in my book, that's dedicated to Amber Dawn, who of course wrote that beautiful book of glossas, where the words end and my body begins. And when I think about that, like, in some ways, like a bloodline or like a word line of, femme queer poets, like this is what I mean to do with illusions, like to create connection and to like explicitly honor and acknowledge writers who make it possible for me to be writing.
Definitely gonna cut that out. And kind of coming off of that as well, I feel like there's in some of your work, it's kind of, you know, talking about Ovid, but even in Tuism, like going back, looking at these, you know, things that are much older than we are. But at the same time, there's a ton of really hyper contemporary stuff in both of your work too. And I love that, like in a place called No Homeland, Kai, you are constantly in these very contemporary spaces populated by young people. Yeah. And I think that that's something that we don't see. And, you know, there's tons of like pop culture stuff in Ali's book. And I think that's something that's sort of newer in the way that we're looking at poetry and sort of almost escaping these old ways of looking at what poetry can be and how it can exist. So, which I love, obviously. If you look at my own work, clearly it's what I care about. But I think, you know, being able to, you know, make it beautiful and still have this amazing language usage, which you both are doing, and to incorporate all of that stuff is so fucking exciting. Like, it makes me feel good about the future of contemporary Canadian poetics when I see that you're doing stuff like that. So were either of you, like, how would you respond to that? Like, did you love it? Were you concerned that you were, you know, be kind more specifically, like that you were going too much into that world as opposed to quote unquote poet world or poet voice? Just, I guess you could talk about both language usage, but also sort of like contemporary or pop culture usage in your work.
Oh man. I mean,
I love it. That's all I'm going to say. Bye.
I mean, I would love to hear what you have to say about this, Ali. I have never really lived in poet world. Mm-hmm. Like, for
good
me,
for you.
You know? Yeah. Like, sometimes really being happy with that and sometimes being like, why can't I? I've never formally studied creative literature, creative writing, or even English after high school. Mm-hmm. And so just don't have access to a large amount of that kind of stuff. Like, most of my literary education after high school, I came about at like the poetry slam, mm-hmm, or at jazz poetry events. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking particularly about Community Vibe Collective in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Like Dina Smith and Jason Blackbird Salmon are two poets who are really important and like helped me learn a lot. So most of that being like spoken word and oral tradition, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I think about the teachings that I learned from those spaces and from those people, what I learned was that when you're doing poetry, you're speaking to who's in front of you and who's in your heart. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I like don't necessarily, yeah, you know, like I think about my, like, so I didn't worry because I was just following the principle, right, of like writing with integrity. And for me, writing with integrity is like writing about who's in your heart and who's around you. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about, yeah, like these spaces populated by young people, I spent so much of the past 10 years surrounded by like queer youth punk, mm-hmm, community, if you want to call it that, right? And all of the intensity and like the violence and hypocrisy that comes with like young anarchist queer communities. Like, mm-hmm, there's a poem in a place called No Homeland where I talk about very particularly like the queer punk scene and like queer punk dance parties and like the hypocrisy of like calling out rape culture on the internet, but then also you know, pummeling your boyfriend,
yep,
so hard that he can't breathe, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, looking around, I remember specifically on the incident, looking around at, like, all these, like, famous queer activists in Montreal and being like, whoa, I think it's a problem. Mm-hmm. And then having them say to me, like, oh, yeah, I just try not to think about it. And I've certainly done that, too, right? Like, I'm not trying to, like, hold myself as more accountable or more morally better than those people, because I just have done some things that are terrible, you know? Oh. And I think about your books too, Leah, actually, mm-hmm, like Riot Lung in particular, mm-hmm, and about like the activist scene. Like, these are the things that I write about because I have to be, right? Yeah. Like, not just because I want to, although I also want to, but like, I just can't see myself in like that space of like writing academically because I've never been there. I don't, mm-hmm, know if you have any responses to that, but.
Yeah, well, you know what it makes me think about is Amber Dawn has this tremendous poem about, gosh, how does it go? There's the girl in the field with the coyote, and she's like, someday I'll write about it. I can't even talk about it. Oh, man.
Yeah, I love that.
Ooh, you can cry. So, yeah. It's all good.
Oh, man. I'm deeply repressed. I can't. It's okay.
I own it. I just really own it at this point.
But no, I mean, I think about, like, that's one of my favorite things about, like, when I think about your work, when I think about Leah Lakshmi Pipes and Sarah Machina's work, and, like, yours as well, Ali, and, like, it makes me reflect on my experience in the MFA program, which I often reflect on, and how fucking heteronormative it is to be like, make your poems universal. Don't make references to social media or pop culture because they'll date your work. And I'm like, how do you do that? Like, how
that makes
something
me want to stabinate.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
that's a stabinating offense.
It's so, and I mean, it's a choice, and there are excellent writers in the world. There are awesome queer writers who do that, right? Like, you know, I'm sure like Adrienne Rich did that, and that's awesome, and she's great. But like, you know, I just don't think I could function, and something about it feels so heteronormative because so much of queer culture is like nuance and illusion and like
context
and context and detail and like thriving on that and also being able to get so focused on context and detail because our context is like subsumed everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So I'm just so excited about that when I see it in other people's work, and it makes me feel really like, It feels really permissive. Like, it feels very much like you can do this too, and it's okay, and it's good because, I mean, I'm thinking about the Juno Diaz article in the New Yorker about like, mm-hmm, for students of color in MFA programs being told like, and I got that feedback so much of like, your character's too niche and I can't understand her. Like, I have no idea what this cultural reference is about. Therefore your poem is inaccessible to me. And I was always like, I don't care. I'm doing middle fingers right
now.
I was like,
that's a two middle finger comment.
Yeah. That's a two middle finger comment. I was like, you know, well, that's too bad for you. Like, I'm obviously not writing for you, and I'm going to write about people who are going to appreciate the location that I'm writing about. Totally. Or the context that I'm writing in.
But also, yeah, the things that are studied in university English programs are those exact things within a white heteronormative context, like a Eurocentric context.
Yeah. But that's what drives us to die.
Like crazy. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Where you're just like, yeah, people use cultural references because that's what happens. And then things become historical fucking documents because they are a product of their time.
Yeah.
That's what holds part of their value. Yeah. It fucking makes me super angry.
Yeah.
I can't with that shit. And it's also at the same time, yes, it's like, it's ruining the ability for people to use the voice they have chosen or their own voice or whatever it is. Like, it's fucked up.
Okay, wait. Because I wrote this essay a while ago about how, I often felt very like judged for caring about pop culture and contemporary culture and writing about it and wanting to write about it. And my whole thing is that if you're part of a whatever your identity is, if you're part of a group that feels marginalized or oppressed, buying into pop culture is often the only way that you can feel that you're part of mainstream or, you know, mainstream culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, as somebody, you know, growing up where I'm visibly different than a lot of people, I often felt like, okay, I can walk into a room and we're not going to talk about like cultural politics, but we can all talk about like what's happening with Selena Gomez in The Weeknd.
Yep.
Let's all talk about that. And you know, when I'm trying to apply for a mortgage and you don't know, like, so for example, when I bought my last house, cause I was, you know, recently divorced and all that other stuff, and didn't know if I could get a mortgage. I'm a writer. I have no money. That's part of it too. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? Let's talk about Taylor Swift and Katy Perry. Like, and then instantly there's some kind of connection. And so it's a buy-in. So when people are like judging me for not liking, I don't know, Wilco or something, I'll, that's a good example. Then, you know, I really care about what Rihanna is doing because it makes me feel like I've got a place in this world where I often feel like there is no place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. You guys can talk about
that. Oh my God. To follow up on that too. And then I also really want to hear what you have to say, Allie, because you look really thoughtful right now.
Allie looks very thoughtful. Scratching chin thoughtful.
Right? I just need to know, but first I have to talk. I'm talking. Oh my God. I think too, like that thing is like, when you're being encouraged to like write a universal poem, it's like assuming the reader, like assuming
that's whiteness, though.
That's a white person, right?
It's totally whiteness.
I'm like, why would I write something blank and universal that like a white person could read and be like, oh, that's nice. Like writing like very specifically directed and addressed poetry that you know, makes a queer reader or a trans woman of color reader be like, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
You're talking to me, you're talking about me. Like, I hate that poetry assumes that the central reader, the person who's like important to like be thinking about writing to and talking to is always like a white guy or a white woman, you know? Like, part of the value of poetry as well is that, like, you can talk to multiple people and you can address you can have multiple speakers and you can also have multiple listeners and readers. And I hate the idea. I hate being erased as the speaker, and I also hate the fact that people I'm writing for are being erased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the time.
Totally.
Yeah. Allie, you look thoughtful.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to need a few days to think about this, but I do think that I do come from a sort of academic writing background, you know, and I was being read like the canon when I was young, you know, and so I find that problematic as well, but I also find it very nurturing and a safe, beautiful spaces to exist in too. And I do think about timelessness when I write, and can this lift out of this just one space and time that I'm in right now into a more universal space and time. I don't know if I'm saying that quite right, but I think about it. I do. But I certainly hope that trans people can find their way into my work in different ways.
Oh, yeah.
And like, you know, I don't know.
I don't think one way is right or wrong. I think they're just both different creative devices and that we've been shut out of having access to one. Like, I think it's such a skill to be able to do what you're doing. And like, that's been the only way I think
in the past that queer writing has functioned in particular is we were like, well, we have to like hide what's happening here and lift it out of this context. And that's the survival skill. Like, yes, that's really
and
awesome.
And I think a lot of my book is that survival skill. Yeah, yeah. And mm-hmm. I think my next book isn't as much. It's more vulnerable mm-hmm. anyway. So we'll see, you know, how that goes. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's mm-hmm. interesting. Survival yeah. skills. Books of survival skills.
Jen and I are eating donuts.
When did that even happen? When did that happen?
I just decided I needed one.
No, I was like, the donuts are gone, actually.
Like, that's not true. There's still some left. Oh,
still donuts. Jen's
Do you need more paper towel, Jen?
No.
Okay, you're fine.
I think the problem is when someone says you can't write like that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yep, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah. And I think that happens all the time. You're right.
Yeah. Or, too, you know, when – and maybe some of it is about access to education and stuff rather than actually mm-hmm. about poetry. But, like, I remember being, like, surrounded by – I mean, I grew up in a really poetry-heavy environment. And mm-hmm. I had, like, super academic family. I had access mm-hmm. to a lot of stuff. But I remember looking at it and being like, oh, my God. Where are we? Like, you know, and I mean, not as far as Jewishness, like there are tons of Jewish poets had all sorts of that stuff all over the place. That was great. But looking at stuff and being like, if I could just parse this and figure out what the heck these people are talking about and not mm-hmm. knowing, like having no idea until I was an adult that all of these famous women writers were huge homos. Like that would have been great to know. I would have loved to have had access to that information. Right.
Or right. I think about, like, going to school on the east side, also on the west side here in Vancouver, where, like, lots and lots of my male peers were Chinese and Korean and South Asian boys who, you know, didn't have, like, a vision of their masculinity and whiteness, mm-hmm. and so really were emulating what they thought was, like, a black masculinity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, anyway, so you have all these, like, Chinese boys sitting in, like, baller shorts and gigantic t-shirts in the mid-thousands in English class, and the white teacher is like, speak English! And that's like, why? And then and she's giving you Shakespeare, right? And she's like forcing people to read Shakespeare out loud. And basically, you know, you can see these like white English teachers treating so many of those Chinese boys, like Chinese male students, like they're stupid, you know? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, those folks are listening to rap and like really connecting and like really, really finding their own space somehow in the black masculinity of rap, which is a very complicated phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But also I think is really beautiful and speaks to the timelessness or like the cultural transferability of rap as poetry, right? Mm-hmm. And then to go into like an academic space, you often hear people talking about rap in these really racist ways, like hip hop in these incredible ways where they're like, it's not poetry, or like it's this mm-hmm. other thing. What they mean is it's less than.
Yeah.
And of course, so much of hip hop is incredibly culturally bound, right? Mm-hmm. Like all the references are to so many very specific things, but are still speaking to multiple audiences in multiple ways. And when I think about, like the idea of like the academic poem, it's not like, I guess like, you know, maybe I get more rankled than I should, but it's not like I'm like, oh, you can't write in this way. Like, or this is the wrong way. I think more about like receiving this message in those English classrooms, public school, Vancouver, East Side classrooms, right? Like not only is what you're listening to or reading wrong, you also are wrong. All of it is wrong. And there's this one way you should all be reading Shakespeare and loving it. Like, when, you know, Shakespeare himself is so culturally bound, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what I struggle with, like, not recognizing, like, the contextual nature of the things we deem universal, and then just, like, the, like, blanket erasure of, like, all of those other kinds of valuable things.
Well, this is something that I've been thinking about all week, or for a couple of weeks now, is accessibility of literature, accessibility of literary events specifically. Mm-hmm. And this happened because many years ago, I remember somebody who was like a event organizer saying to me, why aren't the Chinese Canadian community coming to our events? And I'm like, well, because they don't care, which is ultimately. And then, so the issue becomes, how do you get people to your events? No, that's not the question you need to be asking. Mm-hmm. The question you need to be asking is, how do we program our content mm-hmm. to make sure that those people feel like they're being spoken to?
Yeah.
What are the barriers and how do we remove them with the content that we're programming? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the very key thing. So when we're talking about things like how rap speaks to, because we have a lack of, let's just say, because I'm Chinese Canadian, there's a lack of Chinese Canadian anything in pop culture. Mm-hmm. So black culture is often the thing. that we will look to. So understanding why those connections are being made and mm-hmm. being able to program content, being able to publish books, being able to make spaces in our writing programs that allow for the people to be touching on rap, to be mm-hmm. touching on mm-hmm. whatever it is, Full House, if we want to talk about Full House. For God's sake, somebody write some poems about Full House.
I think someone has.
Probably. We need to Google that. yes, do it right now. But so I think it's less about, you know, trying to make Shakespeare accessible to people mm-hmm. and trying to make what we're teaching or what we're disseminating relevant to mm-hmm. the people that we want, that, you know, literature and culture, people of, you know, in marginalized or oppressed groups are not lacking for culture. It's just that they're looking for other kinds of culture that the people who are the stakeholders in literature specifically don't understand yet.
Yeah.
Which is my little lecture for today. So I'm going to stop.
No, you're totally right. You're totally right. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to start to move on because we have recorded so much. You guys, we could talk about this forever, I feel.
Can we also say just quickly?
Yes.
That accessibility can also include difficult poems, difficult lyrics.
Yes.
And I think sometimes we forget that.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point.
Like, just because we're saying we need to make this accessible doesn't mean we're dumbing down.
No,
it means we're just like bringing in all these different voices.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Totally.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's good. Okay, you know what? Just coming off that, I just wanted to maybe before we move on.
So many Full House poems, by the way.
Yeah, I figured there's got to be a lot.
Did you just Google it?
Tom Hanks has a slam poem apparently about Full House.
We'll listen to that later. Before we wrap up this part and move on, I just thought maybe I would ask if anyone wanted to just give some suggestions or maybe other writers that you think maybe aren't on people's radar that we could be talking about instead of the huge, Is that a phrase that I should be using? Yeah. So if there's anyone that you want to recommend or someone that you think isn't necessarily getting the attention that they in the world deserve. So take them in.
Oh, I already know.
You're ready. Go. Yeah.
I mean, part of the trans woman girl writer code is that you always just rattle off.
That's good. I love that you had this just 100% ready.
Always there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously the folks I always talk about are like Jia Qing Wilson Yang, whose novel Small Beauty is a Chinese Canadian trans woman novel.
It's so good.
There's also so much more than that. Yeah. Gwen Benaway, whose two books of poetry, Speaker for the Dead, and most recently Passage, are best fucking most poetry out there right now in Canada. Just gonna go ahead and say that. Trish Salah has been writing for as a powerhouse for a while. And then I'm gonna say like a writer from the States, actually Kokomo Kinetic, whose first book of poetry, Reacquainted with Life, is currently a Lambda finalist nominee. That book, published by Topside Press just this past year, is fucking amazing. And it's exactly everything we're talking about in terms of like, wow, complex and difficult. But also, a lot of it is written, like, using vernacular, using AAVE, African-American Vernacular English. Also, a lot of it is using not AAVE. A lot of it is writing very specifically about, like, queer and trans cultural contexts that I think also speak emotionally to a really wide range of things. That's Kokomo Kinetic, Reacquainted with Life. It's one of the most mind-blowing pieces of trans poetry out there right now. People should go check that out.
I can go. I mean, I always, like, part of the, I mean, I won the Dane last year, and one of the things I've really been struggling with is that, like, I won and Gwen and Jia Qing didn't. And because they changed the format of the event, like, I think what happened this year was really great that you didn't know until the actual event because it was a really different vibe going in. We all knew. Yeah. So it was also like, I didn't talk to Gwen and Jia Qing about it at the event, but I felt like had it been me being invited to go to an event where I already knew that I didn't win and like receiving a considerably smaller amount of money than the cis girl who won the award, like what is happening there? And so it just didn't have the same like woo award show kind of feeling. I mean, I certainly still felt very grateful to be there, but it just, there was like a tension there with the setup, like the way it was structured. So just my personal commitment has been like every time I have the opportunity to say other writers' names, I'm like Gwen Benaway, Josh Wilson Yang, who like had this incredible opportunity, but just didn't get afforded the same level of publicity that I got. Like it's not the way it worked. So shout out to them. Read
Vivek Shraya. Books.
Vivek Shraya. Yeah. Vivek Shraya for sure. I always say Esther McPhee, who's my co-organizer for Reverb, because Esther does like, if there's something that's working well in East Van somewhere, Esther is behind it, and it's always at the expense of their own personal projects. So look them up. They made us a beautiful Reverb website. And then the other person I was going to say is Indra Das. I don't know if anybody's read The Devourers. Oh my God, read The Devourers. That book is not getting press in the queer world that I wanted it to get. Like I had no, and maybe this is an intentional choice on Indra's part, but that book has some of the best queer sex I've read in my entire life. It's so good. And it's so, like, it's fantasy, and we don't get access to those spaces as writers of color. And like to have a fantasy novel that's totally written in a like historical non-Western context, that's so legit and super queer, is so just smart. It's so important. Yeah, it's so smart. Also, just like props to an awesome survivor narrative written about a woman by a man. Like it's just, it's so good. I was like, I got 30 pages in and I was like, I'm not going to be able to read this book. And then I was like, I can't stop reading this book. What's happening? This is so well done. So yeah.
I spent the summer basically reading Lisa Robertson. So, and she doesn't perhaps need any more shout outs. Yeah. But
doesn't mean Lisa Robertson's not great.
That's
though.
Who I've been with.
Yeah.
Is Lisa Robertson.
You've been having a real great time with Lisa Robertson.
And Eileen Miles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, those are great things that people should be reading if they're not already. I agree.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. We're going to move on to this new segment. It's called Summer Goals. So all I want you to do is just think about what your summer goals are. And I'll start out because mine are pretty easy. I want to eat a wine popsicle.
Oh, I have a good popsicle set.
Well, we'll do that. Uh-huh. I want to do that. I want to consider a novel.
Ooh.
I actually wrote a novel for my thesis in grad school, and then I kind of hate it. It's a piece of trash. So I want a new one.
We'll talk about your novel.
Yeah, we'll maybe talk about that. And I want to read 30 books.
I know.
But I feel like if I hunker down now, I can read 10 a month.
Can you?
Yeah, especially if I'm going to the beach all the time. What else am I doing? Nothing.
You can do it. Read a lot of poetry.
Yeah. If I'm mixing in poetry, fiction, nonfiction, a bunch of picture books.
This book from the 90s, like The Babysitter's Club.
I'm just going to only read Goosebumps.
Animals.
Good, oh, yeah.
Flowers in the Attic in there.
I reread it a couple years ago when they made that Lifetime movie.
Oh my God, with Kiernan and Shipka or whatever.
Yeah, Kiernan and Shipka from Mad Men. Yeah. It was good. It was really good. Okay, who wants to talk about their summer goals? Do people have summer goals? Okay, go.
All right, my summer goal is to cut my hair in permit. It's like a big thing.
Yes, sweet. This is a great goal.
Yes, it's a great goal. I'm gonna call myself, what did I call myself? Long Bob Perm? Kind of like Long Duck Dong, but Long Bob Perm.
We've never brought this up before.
That's 16 candles.
16 candles.
I'm just absorbing this now.
Yeah, isn't this great? It's a good idea. And that's going to be my name for the summer.
Okay.
And I'm going to... Long Bob Perm. And then I'm going to... I know, it's funny. And then I'm going to actually finish writing this poetry book.
Yes.
I've been writing for 2 years. Let's finish it.
Yeah.
So my son and I are going to go to Asia, and I'm actually trying really hard not to work this summer.
Great.
So everything I've been doing has been about not working.
Yeah, nice. That's really good. I feel like less work is good for a summer goal.
Less work and just wear inappropriate clothing. And it's all good.
Well, that's my summer goal every summer.
Yeah.
Inappropriate
clothing. Who's next?
I mean, appropriate is the word.
Yeah.
Well, I think I have nice inverse goals too. So I'm trying to grow my hair out.
Yay!
This is like the first time in 10 years I haven't had long hair since I started dating an anarchist who's a big jerk and cut all my hair off. So woo, taking it back. Yeah, exactly. I cut off my gender. I want it back. Help. So.
Freaking anarchism.
Oh, yeah. The worst. I'm going to do that. And then I just got my leave approved and I'm going to go to the motherland for the first time.
For how long?
2 weeks. 2 weeks. Yeah, I have an excellent travel buddy who I've known since high school, and we're going to go to Romania and Moldova.
When are you going?
July 31st to August 11th, I think, pending travel advisory things if they come up and, you know, getting things planned. But
that sounds great.
Yeah, it's going to be good. And then that will be instrumental in me actually finishing the manuscript, which is like non-existent right now. Ha ha, whoops. The Canada Council didn't hear that.
Super. That's fine. You have so much time.
Exactly. I have tons of time.
This is only February. It's like,
we could have recorded this at any point. Nobody knows. We got you.
Don't make me do February.
We got you. We're not in it. Time is a flat circle or whatever the fuck. It doesn't matter. Allie, what's your summer goal?
No, I don't have any.
Just live great. Life.
No summer goals.
Whoa.
We're going to have our dogs meet.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I hope I get to hang out with Ellie at the beach. This is a good summer.
I guess I am going to mentor two kids with the Claremont Review.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
So we take a break for the summer, but I got to pluck a couple out of the pile and say I'd really like to work with you.
Wow. And they're into it. They're going to work with you.
Oh, yeah. They're really excited.
That's awesome.
That's
yeah.
Why would they not be? I was in the Claremont Review like 20 years ago.
You were?
I was. I had a poem there called Nerve Impulse, which is about sex and throwing up.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's fantastic. Kai, what's your summer goal?
To get published in the Claremont Review.
We've got the editor here.
So just saying, I'm a little late, but not that late.
That's all right.
I remember when I was 14, I used to like look at the Claremont Review and be like, oh, I'll never be published in there.
Oh.
And I never have been. So
no!
Let's see. Summer goals. I mean, similar, Jen. My goal is to not work. I haven't not worked in a really long time in my life. Like maybe since always, but definitely right now, like just to give folks a sense, like I got off work at 6 p.m. on Friday, like ran to the airport,
oh, no.
Took an overnight flight to Vancouver, was at the Dane on Saturday, and now I'm here, and then about an hour from now, I'm going to be on a plane back to Toronto. I'm going to back to work on Monday.
God.
And I mean, oh, I do God. This to myself, right? Like, it's because I'm a workaholic and I'm full of Chinese shame about like working hard enough and making enough money. So yeah, my goal is to figure out how to like let go and just like and not work for a month.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's really great. Mm. I like all your goals. Okay, this is when I become my most self-indulgent.
Yay!
Oh.
Do you want me to? I got the timer. I set it up the timer in advance. Okay, are you ready? This is Dina's Rage Minute.
Ready?
Yeah.
Go.
Thinking and or talking about money. I mean, what? That's not fucking fair to anyone. It's terrible. Nobody wants to be doing that. Canada geese.
Gross.
They're monsters. There are way too many of them. I know they tried to curb their reproduction, but it has not worked, and there are more than ever. Also, they have a gross nationalist name, and they're just super aggressive. I fucking hate them. This straight man complaining about romper situation.
Oh, God.
Just straight men complaining about anything at all. Like, everyone is really tired and they don't have time for that. Yeah. They don't have time for that. That without environmental protections, sea otter habitats will be pretty much fucked, which actually has extremely damaging effects down the line for everything. Mm-hmm. It's fucking, otters are super important to the ecosystem. Not enough mozzarella sticks around. Throw me a deep fried bone. This is unfair. Are we done?
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's over.
A deep fried bone.
Throw me a deep fried Throw me a deep fried bone, guys.
I didn't say it.
Great.
So you repeated it.
Great. Well, I'm
that was
glad.
A good rage minute.
I'm glad we got through that, you guys.
I experienced catharsis.
See, I've been attacked by them multiple times. They're terrible.
That's terrifying.
No one wants that. And they just, even when they've like tried to curb, they're like, there's too many, we're going to cull them. And then more just show up. And they become more aggressive as the years go on. I love animals, obviously. Like I talked about these otters and stuff. There it stopped. But I just don't know what they're doing. Like, I don't know how they're helping us. They're not doing anything good for the ecosystem that I can tell. It's like mosquitoes, Canada geese. What are you doing? That's good. Mm. Anything? Maybe if someone knows, please, I guess, tweet me. I'll listen.
No,
tweet at Cantlet. Then Daniel can also have it.
Jen, do you have any emotions you would like to talk about?
Yeah.
So we're gonna do three rapid fire segments in a row. The rage minute happened. Now we're gonna time Jen's. It's called Jen's Emotion Corner. She's also getting a minute, and then we're gonna talk about things that we love in a contrast, and we're all gonna go around the room and just talk about things that we love. Could be anything. Okay, you ready, Jen?
Okay, I'm starting your timer now.
Okay. Okay, so I'm having a lot of emotions about, I did this panel and we talked about cultural appropriation and writing, and I was having so many emotions up there. And if you look at all the pictures of me from this thing, I look like I'm smelling something that smells very, very bad. And because I was trying to mask the emotions, and Belay Nickerson, who we love, friend of the podcast, kept making funny faces at me from the audience. I'm like, don't look at me, Belay, don't look at me. And then I was like, you know, upset and then angry and then not angry and trying not to look angry. And then I actually started shivering from anger, mm-hmm. which was like amazing. Like, have you ever shivered from like all rage? Yeah, like in, yeah, all the time, like in public. And then like this entire week has been like, great things are happening, bad things are happening, great things are happening, bad things are happening. So now I'm at this point where I'm like a limp rag, and when we got here I had to shovel a dead bird over the fence. And I just feel, I'm sorry, Daniel, there was a dead bird on your deck and I shoveled it over the fence. So you may find it there later when you're trying to do whatever you need to do. And that's how I feel right now. Sorry.
That was amazing. Good also, honor. Yeah, Jen did shovel a dead bird. It seriously wasn't dead when we got here, and then it died while we were waiting for the podcast to start. And then when Ali showed up, Jen was shoveling it over the fence.
That's fitting.
It was a great start to the podcast. Okay, and now we're going to do the rapid fire love minute. Does everyone have some things that they love it that they're ready to talk about?
Sure.
And you're just gonna say like whatever it is immediately. Okay. Leah, I'm gonna start with you.
Sure.
Okay. And then we'll just go around and we'll just like do it rapid. Okay. You're it.
I fucking love chocolate.
Great. I really love my mom.
Aww. I love my mom too.
I love your moms.
I love my mom also. It seemed weird not to.
I really love Instagram. It's good to look at when you feel sad about your own life. Yes, you can look at other people's lives. It's good.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I love boys who ask you how you're feeling.
Good one.
Don't even. Oh. Yeah.
I love Kevin and Daniel Zamparelli's new book.
Oh, that is a great thing to love. Yeah.
I love that I think Canlit's going to be great. And we were just like seriously at a point in time now where everything's going to change and fall apart. And the best things are going to come out of that destruction.
Mm-hmm. I love that too. I love bare legs. I just love having bare legs. It's great.
Oh my God. I love the sun.
Oh yes.
I'm from a very sunny place. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is hard.
I love Faith, the rogue vampire slayer.
Oh yeah. Oh, she's great.
No, let's keep going. Let's go around. One more.
Kai.
Love is real. Love is real.
I think I like my life for the most part.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I think I have a pretty good life.
I love that you love your life. That's good.
Well, most of it, not all of it.
I love that all of you came here today. I love that the Writers Trust asked if I wanted to do this podcast. And I do love the Writers Trust. And Daniel and I had both talked about having both Ali and Kai on the podcast. So the fact that they got to be here at the same time is really amazing. I'm glad that I get to produce this podcast. And even though technically sometimes it confounds me. So we're going to close it down. We're going to shut it down. Thank you all for being here. You can find us at Cantlit on Twitter, Cantlit on Facebook, on iTunes. You can subscribe. Again, please, we really need those 5-star reviews. We need to climb back up the charts. Mm-hmm. And if you want to write a review, I will read it on an upcoming episode. If you don't want to, that's cool. And also cantlit.ca. Anyone else? Do you want to tell people where they can find you, Leah, on the internet?
Oh, you can find me just under my name and then also at The Final Reverb on June 12th. Which
right.
You should come
right.
To.
And you have a website. It's LeahHarlick.com, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Don't find me.
Leave Kai alone. I'm going to make a Chrissy Crocker style video where I'm crying in my bedroom, just yelling about you guys leaving Kai alone. Honestly, that is maybe my new summer goal.
New summer goal. Can I find you?
Yeah, you can find me, Ellie.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh, everyone else listening.
Kai does have a website. It's super easy to find.
Google my name.
Yeah. It's literally the first thing that comes up. Yeah.
Ellie. Yeah. I'm at HiAllieBlythe.com.
That's delightful.
Oh, that is really sweet. That's really good. Oh, you can find Jen at sukfong.com.
Yeah, except I never.
Yeah, that's
true. You don't update it.
I never update it. So,
it's so cute.
It's cute. It's got bubbles. But like I'm at Jen Sukfong. You guys can find me. It's cool.
Yeah,
just go on Twitter. Jen's great. At tweeting. Lucky to have her. So, I'm gonna ask Leah, Kai, and Allie one final question. Mm-hmm. What can't you with right now? Or in general in life, across the board, whatever you want.
I just can't with this podcast being over. I had such a good time talking to all of you.
Oh, Leah, such a good conversation. No one's ever said that. And I can't believe it. I love you so much.
That was beautiful.
Kai, what can't you with? Like, probably so many things, so it's hard to pick.
Oh, God. I can't with Tumblr. Or the internet in general right now. Mm-hmm. But I also can't with how nice everybody has been today.
Well, you deserve it.
Yeah.
The unembodied poem, I'm gonna say.
Oh.
Sorry, guys.
No,
okay.
Man.
I can't.
I feel like we're all floored now.
Yeah, that's great.
Wow. Okay. Yep. This is that's such a great ending.
Can Ellie expand?
He wants to expand.
No, that's no, that's good.
Just leave it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mic drop.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like it's the only way to leave it. Yeah. Thank you to Jen for being my co-host. Thank you, Allie. Thank you, Kai. Thank you, Leah. You've all been great. Daniel, as always, I miss you with so much of my stupid heart, my stupid garbage heart. and
thank you, Eva, for being here in absentia.
Yes. Eva is present because I'm going to put her
splice
words
her in.
Into the podcast. Oh, yeah. God, so I'm going to have to record a little intro for that. But that's all we have. Thank you so much. Goodbye.